Welcome to Bohemiana. My name is George Penny and this is my podcast where I talk to interesting and creative people about whatever they want to talk about. And today I am talking to another comedy crime author. I am talking to Christopher Shevlin. Chris is lovely. He's a really great example of a comedy writer, specifically a genus of English comedy writers who are very thoughtful when it comes to their writing, and you'll hear it in his voice. He's someone who writes some of the most lighthearted and sort of laugh out loud funny stuff, but it's obvious after talking to him that he puts so much thought and care and contemplation into his work, and it was a really great conversation. I was just so incredibly chuffed to talk to him. If you want to know more about him, go to christophershevlin.com. And I can't recommend his books enough. I picked them up, probably around 2015, I started reading him. And I always enjoy seeing another one when it hits the shelves. Okay, but as always, I would like to tell you about the things that inspired me this week. Two things, very far apart. The first one I found by pure chance, and it was the movie The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. I don't know how this movie did not get more publicity. Maybe it's because I'm in Mauritius. Maybe because it's really niche. It's a movie about Nicolas Cage playing Nicolas Cage. Very self-referential, very intertextual. It's not so much Nicolas Cage that makes it, though. It's Pedro Pascal, his co-star, who just eats up every freaking scene. Very, very funny. If you like Charlie Kaufman movies, specifically adaptation with Nicolas Cage, you'll get a lot of the jokes in this. And if you've watched every Nicolas Cage movie from the 80s and 90s, yeah, really great stuff. I laughed out loud through a lot of it. It was weird and wonderful enough to really tickle me. The other thing on a totally different scale is Jerry Stiles' book 999. I mentioned that I had read Jerry Stiles' book Permanent Midnight a few weeks ago, I think now, and it was really excellent. I'm not sure if a junkie sort of memoir from someone who's cleaned up should be on school reading lists, but I think if people read Permanent Midnight, they'd probably never want to use ever. 999's totally different. It's Jerry Stiles going on a bus tour of the concentration camps in Poland. And if that sounds depressing, weirdly enough, it wasn't. The book is a real exploration of humanity through the sort of the subjective, you know, take that only Jerry Stiles could bring to a story. He's very darkly humorous, but he's also got this amazing ability to humanize everything and to make it so much more real than if you were watching, for example, just a documentary or even a Hollywood movie, for example. I absolutely loved it. It really uplifted me in a way which is super odd unless you've read the book, and then you'll get what I'm talking about. Okay, how to get to that, back to Chris Shevlin. I think there's nothing else to do other than just to say, without any further ado, I give you the wonderful Chris Shevlin. We have a lot of books, The Taste, in common. I was reading your books and I'm like, oh, someone's a Woodhouse fan. Are you a Tom Sharp fan as well?
I'm definitely a P.G. Woodhouse fan. I did read Tom Sharp when I was in my teens. I did like him, but I also found him a bit, I think his world seemed really terrifyingly adult.
Very bleak. You know, there's a bit of bleakness there, isn't there?
There's definitely a bit of bleakness. And there's also just, I suppose I probably read them when I was about 14. The one I really remember is Wilt.
Oh.
You know, it being all blow-up sex dolls and stuff like that. It just kind of seemed like, this is for adults, this is what adults like.
Yeah.
I did read them all, but I also found it kind of terrifying.
Your stuff is just like a warm cup of tea. It's so lovely. Like, honestly, it's like someone's made me a cup of tea and sat me down on a comfy couch, and I know I'm going to have a really good time. Were you drawn to doing that? Because it's actually really hard to write. I'm someone who writes comedy. Comedy is very subjective. It's really hard to write comedy. You're making yourself very exposed, like, and vulnerable to the reader there. So how do you find that? How do you navigate that? Because you strike me as someone who, you know, might be a little bit more reserved. You're not the bells and whistles, you know, balloon sort of waving sort of person.
I find it really, really, really difficult. Yeah, you've correctly spotted that I'm not a bells and whistles, balloon waving sort of person.
Most writers aren't.
I feel like I'm possibly at the far end of the non-balloon waving spectrum. I do. I find it really difficult. I find the hardest thing about this whole thing is kind of, I feel really, really ashamed of it all. You know, I feel really ashamed of my writing.
You're the first person to actually articulate that. I've had so many conversations
really?
With fellow authors. The only time I've ever had this conversation is probably with romance writers fellow, because I write rom-coms and I also write comic crime, comic fantasy. So I sort of sit in your camp, your genre, but I also write rom-coms.
Yeah, I was amazed at how much stuff you managed to write and how well it all seems to be doing.
Oh, there's a lot sitting there that haven't been published yet. But I do have an excuse. I ended up in Saudi Arabia in 2008 with not much to do. And there's nothing like looking for an exit that inspires you to do stuff.
Yeah.
but when you said ashamed, like, I really identify with that. Would you mind chunking down on that? Is it because of, like, technique, style, or just feeling exposed?
Partly, I don't really come from a kind of creative family.
Same.
Right.
Yeah.
And so kind of doing anything to do with your imagination, the feeling was a bit like, you know, it's all a waste of time. You really should have a proper job, or you should be trying to get a proper job.
When your first book became successful, I remember when your first one came out. I love the genre. So I'm the first person Amazon's going to be recommending books to. You have an amazing cover. So bam, I'm in there. I'm having a look at it. My question, I guess, when my first launch happened, my first book came out, I think it was 2014, and everyone else is going, oh, are you really excited? Are you really just over the moon? And I was sitting there going, no, I'm really depressed. This is horrendous.
Yeah.
This is wonderful, but it's also really horrendous. Where's a bottle of wine? Can I just hide under a table somewhere? Did you have anything like that?
Yes. I don't know. It's had lots of ups and downs, and I guess that has kind of led to my getting a bit ashamed about it. You know, sometimes I'm really excited about it. It just seems incredible. And then when that's not going on, I kind of default back into being ashamed again. So when it first came out, I uploaded it to Amazon and felt terrible about having done that.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but I can identify so hard with this.
And
I know a lot of authors will.
It was partly because, so I've had three agents altogether. The third of my agents was at Curtis Brown. And when I got signed by them, I kind of thought, oh, okay, this is really going to happen this time. This is going to be amazing. And then it didn't again.
No. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say it like that, but I've seen it. I've been there myself. It's a horrible feeling. It's awful. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it takes a while to kind of get over it. But self-publishing was kind of taking off, so I thought I might as well just make it available. So I did that, and I felt really bad about doing that because my fantasy had always been about going into this oak-panelled room in some ancient publisher's offices and, you know, signing the contract. Have you ever read The Plague by Albert Camus?
Yes, I have. It's actually a favourite of mine. That sounds awful. That sounds really awful, but it is.
There's a lot that's funny in that, but I really remember that. There's a character who's been obsessively reworking the first paragraph of his book, and he thinks that if he can get that right, then
it'll
go to the publishers and someone will say, Hats off, gentlemen. This is the book we've been waiting for.
This is it. Actually, you're right on a topic that I've been talking about so much right now with so many authors, especially with this PIH versus DOJ case going on in the States. I don't know if you've been following it at all.
No.
Okay, so if you want to descend yourself into a well of despair, go look it up. Or if you want to congratulate yourself for being an independent author who's successful in your own right and not falling into a well of despair, also look it up. Essentially, what's happening is the US government has launched an action against Penguin Random House because they want to buy Simon Schuster. And effectively, it's an antitrust situation because they're reducing the two biggest publishers in America down to one, which is an issue. If you follow the Twitter threads, there are a few marvelous people who are actually attending the court cases and doing the tweets in threads. But by now, I think Esquire's done a brilliant summary of it and everything. And the way traditional publishing talks about authors, it's very, very depressing. It's really not great. And I got a three-book deal with Penguin really early on in my career, going through the back door of an ebook thing, and then they gave me three deal, no advance or anything. It was very much what it was. And having been in that camp, I can tell you that being an independent author is just so much less stressful and so much less annihilatory of your self-esteem. Like, no one really talks about the anxiety that comes with waiting on agents to sub, the feeling when it gets cancelled, you know, when you know, they're like, oh, well, they didn't buy the book, they didn't like it. Why didn't they like it? Oh, they didn't like it.
Yeah.
They don't like me? What's wrong with me? Like, that's where your head goes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. I got traditionally published for a couple of non-fiction books, so I do have a little bit of experience with them, but I suppose I have a bit more experience just from talking to people who have been traditionally published. I do get the feeling that they don't really have any respect for writers at all.
No.
You know, unless they're making millions.
I've got a mate who I was talking to who hit the jackpot. He was lucky enough to hit the jackpot. And he did have one of those marvelous big auctions for his book and everything. It was amazing watching him initially because it was his debut, which in itself is amazing. So to have mega success on your debut novel. But by novel three or four, where obviously if you've got a massive success, it's like that Elizabeth Gilbert thing where, you know, the author of Eat, Pray, Love. She did that amazing TED talk where she said, I've peaked at 40. What now? Like, she's like, realistically, I'm never going to sell as many copies as this one. So what's going to happen now? And watching
that's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, and watching how publishing changed for him when book two, three, four never sold as well as the first one. And how, you know, suddenly the bottles of champagne aren't turning up on launch day. And, you know, suddenly it's like the, you know, the partner who stops calling. And stop sending flowers. Yeah, it's a little. It was really hard to watch actually, because you could actually see the disappointment starting to kick in.
Yeah, I can imagine that must be so horrible. Yeah, and just the feeling that they're economizing on champagne.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's like, and I'm worth now what, a box of crisps or something? I'm not worth champagne. Whereas one of the great things I love about being indie, and I don't know if you find this, is your career is as long as you want it to be. It's not metered on some corporate, you know, budget for whether or not they're going to put a sales budget behind your book or not this time. Or...
Yes. I mean, I think basically everything about self-publishing has ended up being better than any realistic prospect with publishers. But I think probably it's quite hard to deal with the fact that traditional publishing isn't anything like you kind of hope and assume it's going to be when you're growing up.
And it's horrible, I think maybe, right?
Yeah, I think maybe it was a bit more like that in the in the 80s and especially before, because I remember reading that, you know, publishers might kind of get a manuscript and think, this is not quite there yet, but if we put this one out, then maybe the book after next will be a really good one.
Could you imagine that happening now? Yeah, that's a Cinderella story. Yeah. I remember I was reading an interview with romance author Susan Elizabeth Phillips. So she's the shit in the States. Like, she was in the 90s. Not so much now. Her readership's changed. But she got her first deal in 1980 by calling up a publisher's office and saying, I've got an idea for a romance novel. I'm a school teacher. And the chief editor at Avon, which, you know, well, I don't know if Avon was an independent publisher at the time, but they were huge, just went, do you want to come in? That sounds amazing. Why don't you write it for us? Do you want $50,000 or however much it was? Like, it was a ridiculous amount of money. And it's just, could you imagine that happening today?
No, I can't imagine that. That's incredible. Yeah, that's
wonderful. I know. I just read the other day that Hemingway earned the equivalent of $5 a word during his career.
Right, okay.
Like, doing the math on that, no wonder the guy was doing so well.
Yeah, well, I was trying to do the maths on the inflation of what $5 was worth while he was writing it.
It's not bad.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's probably, I don't know, a week's wages from working in a factory or something in the 30s when he started.
Yeah.
Or no, it was earlier than the 30s, wasn't it, when he started?
Yeah, it was probably the teens, I think. My Hemingway life span, as far as I'm concerned with Hemingway, he drank hard, he liked cats, and he pretended he was very, very manly.
Yep. Yep,
I love his writing, but yeah.
Yep, that's pretty much what I know about him. Also, I've discovered I'm very ignorant about the relative value of the dollar over the last 100 years.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't think people expect you to have that as encyclopedic knowledge. I think you're fine. So what drew you? So you started off, I know I'm a bit all over the place, but there's so many questions I had. I reread your books over the last month, thinking, I've needed a comfort read. Like, honestly, since the pandemic, my head's just gone to, you know, I do love the odd book that basically makes me want to tear my eyeballs out at the same time. You know, a good, you know, literary, why am I reading this? I'm being educated, is always great. But I like a comfort read, and your books are just fantastic. What draws you to the humour? Like, why is the humorous writing something you always love, or are you just someone who can't imagine life without laughter?
But finding things funny has always been just really important for me. Mm-hmm. Probably won't surprise you that I'm a bit of a depressive. All through my life, whenever I've found anything that's really properly made me laugh, it's just seemed like this huge beacon and relief. And also, there's something really lovely. If an author can make me laugh, then they have to be thinking in the same way as me and in some way. And so there's also something really relieving about just kind of encountering another mind that's a bit like yours, that's kind of doing things on a page that you thought, you know, that your brain only did in private. You didn't
Isn't it
know
lovely?
You were allowed to write. Yeah, yeah, really, yeah. Really, really is. Always found that really absolutely wonderful. You know, like, I really remember the first time I watched Airplane, the film.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it's just so kind of transformative. All the Douglas Adams books were really like that for me. And Monty Python was like that. Blackadder, I suppose, and a few of the TV
Blackadder's
comedies.
Timeless. I mean, I was rewatching an episode and I know all the words by heart by now.
Oh, really?
But it's still funny. I'm
like,
why is this so funny? Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it is great.
I was just talking to Tony, my partner, about Red Dwarf the other day and the first time we saw Red Dwarf.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that when it started, yeah.
Just seeing Chris Barry being Arnold Rimmer, just being that pencil neck, I call them pencil sniffers, someone who's obviously also such a failure. Like, there was something so wonderful, and he still is the hero, effectively. Like, he's the anti-hero, but he still gets his moment in the sun. I remember just thinking it was wonderful.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a really big thing in comedy, I think, is kind of celebrating failure or kind of celebrating the ways in which we all kind of fail as humans and worry about that.
Yeah.
There's something very kind of leveling and egalitarian about that. I don't know. It just seems to kind of open up the idea that maybe your terrible failings as a human are not that
normal.
Yeah, are normal. maybe they're not a terrible thing. Maybe it's okay. So yeah. So when you really laugh at something, there's this kind of built-in kind of idea that, oh, maybe it's okay. Maybe everything's all right.
I think British humour does that so well. I think a lot of American humour, and I love American humour too, can be built a little bit more on ridicule, like that sort of tradition of humour. But not all of it by any means, but British humour is just so good at going, I'm a fuck-up, you're a fuck-up, we're all a fuck-up, let's have fun. And that's something that I just... Actually, that said, have you ever seen the comedian Maria Bamford? Have you ever seen her comedy?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Once or twice, yeah.
My favourite thing she ever did, she had a bit of a breakdown. Her career just went, you know, tits up, basically. And she had to go back to live with her parents at 35. And she created a little YouTube show.
I remember hearing about this.
And look it up if her thing is, like, she's just so wonderful. The Maria Bamford Show on YouTube. It was so good to see someone, like, she'd literally been found wandering the streets of LA. She'd had a psychotic break. Her head had just had a moment. And basically she'd needed a little time out back home, you know, to get her meds back on. And the show's wonderful. And I've seen her live, and she's just one of the best. I've never been in a more loving audience. I was sitting in the audience next to two dudes in London who smelt so strongly of pot. I was like, you two are as high as kites. And then I had a nana and her grandson on the other side. Family of Indian tourists in front of us. They'd just come across to see family, and they decided to see Maria Bamford because they loved her. And it was like, oh my goodness, like the humour, like the fact that she just lets herself be vulnerable, but in a really goofy way, lets everyone else identify. It doesn't matter class, race, what have you.
I'll have to look her up because I saw her years and years ago, and only for kind of about 10 minutes. She seemed to be doing a slightly more kind of standard stuff when I saw her.
Yeah. Oh, look up the YouTube Maria Bamford Show. It's just...
Right,
it's fantastic.
Okay, also, I may be being unfair to her, and I've not really remembered properly what she was doing.
Her other excellent special is she did a whole paid comedy special to her parents in her house. She got all the money from Netflix and went, well, I'm doing it to my mum and dad. And she's, by that stage, she's already filling auditoriums. I mean, she can pretty much go anywhere, but that's her thing. You know, it's like... And I love that there's space for that, going back to that idea that comedy is a unifier. It's just that space that allows everyone to go, oh, so you don't have to look like a mega success all the time. You can just look like someone wearing pajamas talking to your parents.
Yeah. I think it is a real relief to come into contact with it. It's also a slightly mysterious thing. Because I feel like there's quite a lot of comedies that I see where I don't feel like they're doing anything that's incompatible with what we've just said. It feels like I should be able to like it, but for just some reason I can't quite connect with it. And it's always strange which ones you're going to connect with and which ones you're not.
You're right. Yeah, you're so right. Who was I talking to? I was talking to someone about, it could have been Queef McDonald or someone, about why publishers are so leery of buying comic books. And I've encountered this, you know, my entire career.
Yeah, all my agents have told me that they never buy comic books.
Yeah. And it's you know, they're kind of like kryptonite, because if they hit the zeitgeist at the right time, they do. I mean, my books independently do really well. I've obviously found my audience. You've obviously found your audience, and they're growing. But for an agent or a publisher to take a punt on that, because and the way it was explained to this person was that a comedy is so subjective. If you put hilarious novel on the front of a book and someone picks it up and reads it and it doesn't connect with them, they'll feel shortchanged and they'll get really angry. Whereas if you say heartbreaking novel on the front of a book, someone reads it, the dog dies, even if they're not crying, they're like, oh, well, that's sad. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's I agree. I think that's definitely true. I think because people want to feel that way so much, you know, they want that relief of laughter so much. It is really disappointing when you don't get it. And also, I think most of the other things that books are trying to do tap into more kind of universal emotions that are probably a bit easier to reliably hit in a certain way. Yeah.
We're obviously doing the wrong thing. We need to be killing more kids and grannies and puppies. Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking this the other day. Why aren't I just killing off, you know, why aren't I writing Old Yeller again and again and again? I could be going for, what's it called? Misery. No, that's Misery Memoirs, but Misery Lit.
Yeah. There does seem to be a lot of that about. I'm just kind of accepted that I don't understand publishers, and I don't understand what they like, and I also don't really understand what anyone else likes or enjoys. I really don't understand those kind of very bleak, very short sentence crime books that are inevitably about dead children. I can't cope with them. I don't know what's going on with them.
I can relate to that. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've probably by sheer dint of my gender and the fact that I spent a few years as an expat, why if I ended up getting invited to numerous book clubs and just sitting there while people are talking about a book that I can't get into at all, but they've obviously really connected with it. And I'm the worst person to have a book club. I'm just awful. I'm really awful. I'm just not reverent enough. I can't take stuff serious. I can intellectualize it. I can't take it seriously enough.
Yeah.
And just having that moment of going, oh, I've got to be really respectful because everyone here has really been affected by the dog dying book, whereas I read it and found it very cynical.
It's just mysterious, isn't it?
I think actually in a way, you know what will hit the zeitgeist in a way, like you're obviously picking up there is a hole left by Douglas Adams, there is a hole left by Terry Pratchett, there's been a, you know, there's a huge audience there who are just looking for that kind of humor. There's a hole left by the like Blackadder and stuff like that. The fact that they're still running it again and again and again means that there's not another version of that that's quite hitting the spot for people. So yeah. I think you must be picking up those people.
So I was just thinking again about this shame thing, because I think it relates to what you've just been saying, that it's people's kind of outrage and disappointment when it doesn't work for them. I have sold quite a few now, despite not having done any of the things you're meant to do, and I do quite often get, you know, nice reviews and people emailing
me. This is because you've written really good books. I mean, it's disgusting, but you've written marvelous books. What can you do? I mean, despite yourself, they're out there and people love them.
Yeah, I don't know, but I've also written three of the worst books that have ever been created.
I challenge you there. I would challenge you there. I have read a book with canned cheese used as an erotic item. I can beat you there, hands down.
Okay.
That by far was the worst book I have ever read.
Yeah, maybe I should get in touch with some of my one-star reviewers and say...
I think you should.
Would it have been worse if I'd put the canned cheese erotica in it?
No. Oh, you know, one-star reviewers are their own species of person, because it's a very specific person who will write a one-star review.
And yeah, I suppose so.
I've talked to so many authors about this, and I've talked to so many people. Like, you know, we all have to review everything nowadays. We literally, even if we don't want to, we get asked to. And when you think about it, have you ever actually written a one-star review for something? And if you have, was it for anything that, you know, didn't threaten to kill you?
I have written one-star reviews. I've never written one for a book. I suppose the only times I've done it have been, or I've bought something, you know, a thing that was meant to do a job.
Yeah.
And it was just clearly never, ever going to be able to do that job.
Yeah.
But then also I know that if it's a hose that doesn't work properly, then no one's going to get upset if I say this is a rubbish hose. You know, yeah. probably no one put that much of themselves into that hose pipe. So yeah. It's probably fine, probably just warned some people that it's
don't buy the hose.
If people take anything away from that this interview, I hope it's that message.
Don't buy the hose. Well, I think with a one star book review, I mean, the book reviews are such an interesting thing in the first place. The fact that we actually,
yeah.
Because I like thinking about us as, you know, a writing career, a singer can go do gigs, you know, their albums can be out and they can be reviewed online. But let's face it, they can do a gig and make money in ticket sales, or, you know, actors, you know, do various things. What does an author have? We literally have sales that are garnered by reviews. And I think there's an element of reviewers kind of, there's either a cognizance of that by a certain kind of one-star reviewer. I think another kind of one-star reviewer, you know, they're sold a thing and they're outraged that thing isn't what they wanted. Mm. Usually, I don't know about you. You don't. I have sex scenes in my rom-coms, and it's amazing how many one-star reviews I get from Patty in the Midwest in America, who are like, that scene you did at 150. Page 150 is disgusting. And at page 157, and at a page 159, and after, you know, she's obviously avidly reading it. And it's so political. Do you read them?
Oh, yeah, I read all of my reviews.
Why? Why? Why do you read your one-starers?
Well, I suppose I read them partly because I read all the others. And so it's too difficult to not read a one-star review. It's too difficult to stop in the middle of the first sentence. I mean, I read reviews in general because when they're good ones and people kind of express what it's done for them, that kind of reminds me of what books I like have done for me, then I kind of, you know, I really, really feel much better for having, you know, they do me a lot of good, those ones. And I suppose also because I feel like you reading all the reviews does help to kind of give you a broad sense of how the whole spectrum of people will be reacting to it. The criticisms people make in a 3 or 4 star review are things that then kind of hang around in my
God, the 3 stars bite. Like, honestly, but the number of authors that are like, I've got this rule that if a friend leaves me a 3-star review, they're off the Christmas card list.
Oh,
it's
really?
Like, not really, but it's a case of, you know, how a lot of people will leave a 3-star because they want to look intelligent, especially if it's a sort of a funnier or lighter book. They save the 4 and the 5 for the literary novels, and that's how they think.
Yeah, people have such different kind of philosophies of how they leave review. There are definitely some people, not just with my books, but with all sorts of books, that you read a 4-star review and it's kind of obvious that person is kind of thinking, only an absolutely perfect book is going to get a 5-star review from me, and they might leave 1 or 2 in their whole lifetime. But they'll leave these absolutely gushing 4-star reviews.
Yeah, and what can you do?
Yeah, it's fine, really. I quite like that, and I quite respect those people. Then there's other people who kind of, they're just binary, that if they like it, it's automatically a 5-star. If they don't like it, it's automatically a 1-star. Encouraging other people to read it or warning other people off it.
Oh, yeah, the one that's like, do not read this book, whatever you do. Don't go anywhere near it. Put a perimeter zone around it. Oh, my God, it'll scar you for life, usually. I don't mind the melodrama sometimes. Do you think there'll be a point where you'll stop reading reviews and just sort of, or is it still at the stage where you're like, no, I do want to see them?
I think I will always read reviews just because I do want to know, you know, what it feels like to receive these things if you're sitting in someone else's brain. Yeah, I'm really interested to know what people think and how people genuinely react. And I know that, you know, some of my feeling awful about bad reviews is kind of, you know, just about the state I'm in at the time.
Oh, they always come across at the worst time too. You'll be having a flat day and then a 1-star turns up and it's like, oh, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I always agree with the, well, I tend to always agree with all of them, really. Mm. When I read a really good review, I kind of feel like, oh yeah, those bits were really great, you know. Yeah. And then I read a couple of days ago, one of those really, really detailed 1-star reviews. It's kind of,
ouch, you know, they're the worst.
It's an essay. And it kind of begins with a thing that means that that basically should say, don't take this to heart. Because she says, I was in a book group that read his first book and everyone else really loved it, but I didn't like it that much. So I decided to give his second book a go recently. And I hated it for the reasons that I will now describe in the next 4,000 words.
So Gladys didn't want to be in book club. That's the problem. You've got peripheral book club angst probably a little bit too.
There is this kind of dual thing, you know, that these books clearly are, you know, if they don't work for you, then they are terrible.
I think that's the risk of being a comic writer. This is literally something. Like, I've got mates who write just straight erotica, for example. You're either, you know, and you'd think something like that would be pretty divisive, because if you get that wrong and you don't make someone happy, you'd think you'd get a little bit of rage. Like, I was planning to have a really nice night in tonight and it didn't work out how I thought it would. You'd think you'd be getting 1-star reviews. They don't so much. The same with people who write straight romance. Without the humour and without the comedy elements, the people who write crime, it's the comedy that seems to engender fury. I think it just actually brings out the red rage in some people when it doesn't work for them. I actually think I've talked so much with people about this, and I think that the thing that I'm more and more aware of nowadays as writing funny stuff that I find funny, I now read it and think, would someone having a bad day think I'm ridiculing them?
Okay.
I sometimes think, what's one of the worst insults you can give someone maybe in the UK? I know in Australia, it's telling someone they have no sense of humour. It's like a pretty scathing insult.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, there is that aspect of it.
And I have a feeling, and this is just, you know, a off the back of a packet theory, that maybe people, if they don't get the jokes, you know, your humour doesn't mesh or my humour doesn't mesh with them, that they feel like you're accusing them of not having a sense of humour, and that hits something quite primal.
Yeah, I think there probably is something, there's something in that.
One of my favourite authors in the whole wide world is Terry Pratchett. I went and had a look at Terry Pratchett's 1-star reviews and they are horrific. They're really, really scathing, and it's just like, what is this? And they usually accuse him of immaturity, which usually happens. It seems to be an insult that comes towards comedy authors. Have you ever copped that one?
I don't think so. There are many other terrible things that I have
done. It was just amazing, and I'm reading all of these just going, did you guys read the same book? You know, or Woodhouse. I'll go back and read Woodhouse. Reviews that people have gone to the trouble to 1-stars to write about P.G. Woodhouse. And I'm like, okay, well, obviously my brain and this person's brain are just so completely different, because that book that gave me so much joy made that person stay so miserable that they spent 3 hours writing an essay about why they hated it.
You know, I don't ever feel bad about reviews where it's clear the person leaving it was never going to enjoy that kind of book.
Yeah.
Like there was, you know, one where they even managed to spell the word book wrongly. And I kind of thought, I don't mind you not liking it. But then, I don't know, when people seem intelligent and articulate and they seem to like all the same books I like and they hate my book, then that is a bit more...
personal.
Yeah,
right?
It is a bit more personal.
Have you ever watched someone read one of your books, though?
No. No.
I'm going somewhere with this because this fascinates me. So I have, on numerous occasions, been sitting near people reading my books for various reasons. One or two times I was on public transport or a plane or something.
Oh, like, really? Oh, wow.
Oh, this is happening.
Oh, that's the Holy Grail.
It's nerve-wracking. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. I basically whittled my pants just going, now this is anxious. But the bit that got me the most is people never laugh at the bits that I find funny in my own work.
Oh, really?
So I will have something that just tickles me to the core, to the point where, like, I'm sure you're the same. Your own stuff makes you laugh. Otherwise, why are you writing it? You know, you're writing your stuff. And it'll be a point where I'm giggling. And I was sitting there. I remember sitting next to this lady on a flight to Kuala Lumpur. And I'm just waiting till she gets to the bit where I know it's just funny. And I'm like, I just want to see that smile. And she laughed two paragraphs earlier. Like she was running a finger over the frickin' page. She laughed two paragraphs earlier at something that in no way, shape or form did I find funny. I actually had to pull up the manuscript when I got to Kuala Lumpur and go, how is this funny? How is this? And it was a real eye-opener in that because I've met people that I thought I'd click with immediately because of like the books I do. And then I've realized they've not found any of the bits in those things funny that I did. It's one of those really weird things.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there is something a bit disquieting about it because it seems to kind of undermine the whole thing in a way. I suppose a lot of this is, it's just things that add fuel to a part of, I think probably most people who kind of create, or at least a lot of people who create stuff, have some kind of shame about creativity and what they're doing. And so anything that kind of agrees with that shame is...
confirmation bias almost, right?
Yeah, it's going to be quite... your mind tells you it's very important that they agree with that strand of what you're thinking about yourself in any case.
I actually remember I sent my editor, I've got a lovely American editor for my rom-coms, and I sent her a picture of a Dungeons and Dragons kobold shaking, holding a little sword. And I said, this is me being a neurotic chihuahua. This is literally what I'm like right now. So could we please be nice with the edits as far as the feedback? Like, you know, slash and burn, but no in the margins, oh my God, I can't believe that you're repeating this word 50,000 times. I've never met an author who isn't, you know, if not someone who can crash and burn, you know, because it is a roller coaster profession. Yeah, how have you found that with yours? So you said you put the first one out in 2012. And then was there a little bit of space between them?
Yeah, yes, there's been a ridiculous amount of time between all of them. Because with the first one, I kind of put it out thinking I might as well. I hope this, you know, it felt like a lottery ticket. Either this will sell millions or no one will buy it. And if no one does, then I can just forget about this whole book writing thing. And do something more sensible, and which I have decided once before in my life. I decided to stop trying to write books. Well, yeah, I thought it was a stupid idea. And that time, the next day, I got an email out of the blue from a literary agent asking if he could represent one of my books.
Oh, lovely. So it's just that roller coaster kicks in again and off you go.
Yeah. So that was kind of my chance to get out. That was in 2009.
What we see as readers, like if I've got my reader hat on, is I see you've got these amazing covers, your books are hilarious, you look like a massively successful author with these wonderfully branded, really, really funny and fabulous books. But then the thing that intrigues me is then you hear about what went into creating them. And it's never simple. It's never just that story of, well, I sat down and wrote a book and then it was really successful and everything was great. And I bought myself champagne.
No, certainly not that. Yeah. With the first one, some nice things happened and I got a review in The Guardian and some other places, but it didn't really sell many copies. I think after about 6 months it had sold, I don't know, 700 copies or something like that.
That's better than traditional publishing.
There was someone I knew who a friend of his had a book traditionally published and it had only sold 312 copies. So my early efforts, that was the benchmark I was hoping to hit. I was hoping to get to there. But yeah, anyway, it kind of died and I kind of thought, oh, well, that's it then. I'll just stop writing these. And then I made it really cheap and sort of forgot about it. And I got a big freelance copywriting contract and was doing that. And then just the effect of making it very cheap just over time made sales kind of tick up. Suddenly it was selling kind of, I don't know, 100 copies a day or something. And then I put it up to a normal price and it carried on, you know, sales went higher.
Kept ticking away.
And so it was suddenly earning kind of as much as I was earning as a freelance copywriter, but I was in this contract that meant I kind of couldn't just immediately drop everything and start writing another book. I also didn't know how long those sales would carry on for. I've also been kind of pursued around the world by the housing crisis and started in London where it first really kicked off. And so, yeah, there's always been some big thing happening that has meant that I couldn't just get down to writing another book while the current ones were being successful. So that happened with the first book. You know, I started writing the second book about a year later in the end. After the big spike, I kind of really got down to it about a year after that had finished. And again, I was kind of thinking, I have to do this. I have to, having had that spike and this being my lifelong dream, I have to kind of do another one and just see if anything can come of it. I'm expecting it won't, and that at that point I will kind of finally do something really sensible.
I get the picture of you doing this at 80, going, one of these days, one of these will flop so colossally, I'll go to do something sensible. Sorry, you were saying, so you got back to writing the other one after another wee bit for the third one?
So with the second one, it looked like that had flopped. And then it took about a month or two after I'd released it for it to start selling. And then a couple of months after that, I had this day where it sold 2,000 copies in a day or something. And
something, you know, happened.
Being in an Amazon promotion, but it had been kind of, you know, going up before that. But again, I was kind of in a freelance copywriting contract and had nowhere to live. And, you know, so by the time I wasn't in a contract and did have somewhere to live, sales were kind of well down again. So
I can relate so hard to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by that time I was kind of, you know, they were still doing quite well. I was still making maybe half of the income I would want from them.
That's great.
But it no longer had that feel of, this is what you're born to do. Everything's going magnificently. This is absolutely the sensible thing to do. So again, I wrote another book kind of thinking, well, I have to, because the first two did have those big...
Yep.
If I had managed to just spend the time writing those and hadn't let momentum fall, then everything would be going exactly the way I wanted it to.
Yeah, yeah.
I had sold a lot of books and made, you know, good money out of them.
Yeah.
And so it felt like, well, even though they're not selling amazingly now, I should do this third one and then do something sensible once that flops. And then that one was the one that, the only one that has really, really totally failed to flop in every way, because that kind of did well immediately. All three of them then sustained sales really well for about a year afterwards.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, so for anything, that's phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Do you think so?
Yes.
Okay, that's good to hear.
My goodness, yeah. For a year of sustained sales, so far out. Yeah, I can earnestly tell you from any publishing perspective, that is amazing. That is that is consistent success. Yeah, I will try not to be jealous right now and not to give you the stink eye, but no, no, that is quite marvellous. It really, really is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I felt really kind of good about the whole thing. And I thought, finally, I'm in this situation where, you know, I'm earning what I would hope to make out of freelancing. I'm earning out of these books that I've created, and I can write full time. And then during that time, my grandma died, which
kind of
knocked me off course for quite a long time. And then I inherited some money off my grandma, which ought to be a kind of great thing. But I really let that kind of knock me off course as well, because I kind of had to, it was for the purposes of buying a house.
Yeah.
And it was when house prices were just going massively up.
Oh, goodness.
And I don't know, I kind of went from having this weird time of having a year and a half sitting on my own indoors, just kind of, you know, because of the pandemic, to suddenly having to try to buy a house when everyone else was trying to do it. And prices seemed to be doubling every day and all this. And I didn't know where to live either.
Yeah, where did you decide on? Have you picked somewhere?
I bought a house in Leeds.
Oh, lovely. You're up north. I am married to a Yorkshireman. So,
really?
He's an Aussie. Okay. He's a hybrid Aussie Yorkshireman.
Right.
First generation Australian.
Sounds like a good combination.
I like it up north. I really like it up north in the UK. I think there's sort of a perception on things that's a little bit more forgiving than the London sort of setup.
Yeah, I don't know. I was very unsure about the whole thing.
Could I just share? I'm complimenting Yorkshire. And I've got my husband just walked into the room. The kitchen's over here. And he's just pulling the Yorkshire, like the mopey dour face. His mum's got every ailment under the sun. His relatives have, you know, it's that very northern, let's complain about the feet, let's complain about the heart attack, let's complain about... So I've got a very optimistic view of the north. Tony's a Yorkshireman in that respect.
Right.
How are you finding it, though?
Well, I tend to find that everything is just a succession of calamities that totally destroy me.
Are you
massively...
having my life too?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, wow. So it's just everything. We always say, and then something happened. And then it happened again. There's always something, right? Always something.
Yeah. I always feel like I'm, you know, just massively oversensitive to everything and don't manage to take anything in my stride at all.
It's probably what makes you an excellent writer, though. We are little kobolds shaking in the corner, I think, sometimes. Go eat your cereal. Did you hear the laugh?
Yeah, that was a really excellent chuckle.
Tony's an author too, and because we're two authors in the same house, we are the most neurotic... Fruit Loops. So everything you're saying about, you know, it being a roller coaster, we can really relate.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't have that perception of you two at all from seeing all your stuff and, you know, how productive you are. And I was really envious of you because it seems like it would be great to, you know, to be married to someone else who... thinks the same way and does the same sorts of things.
It does help. So one of the good things is when I'm having a shit day and I'm like, it's like, you know what it's like, you're writing a book and I talk about writing a book like, it's great, I'm writing the best book ever. Oh my God, it's shit. I'm shit. Everything's shit. Why am I so shit?
Yeah.
I want to sit in the corner and just mope. And then, you know, and then I'll be, you know, for 5,000 words more going, I'm amazing, it's working, I'm laughing, and then it's back to shit. Well, Tony's used to my patterns now, so the minute I start with the it's shit, he comes in and kicks my ass and just goes, shut up and keep writing. I don't want to hear it. I know this is what you do. And it's not even making me a cup of tea or anything. It's like, no, I'm not even feeding this. Just sit down and do the fucking work and then we'll talk later. That's literally... And I do the same for him. So we know each other's patterns.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, and because it is really... So you're writing... Do you have a reader that you send your stuff to, or are you solo the whole time you're working on your stuff?
No, I have... Well, for my first book, it was my agent who kind of did the...
That's stressful, right?
What's the word? The structural edit. Actually, no, I found it really wonderful. I found it really, really great. Because I'd been in lots of writers' groups before that, where people tend to read as writers. And so, you know, people are kind of just pulling apart every sentence and suggesting things that, you know, kind of, yeah, that would be how you would do it. But
it's not how, you know, it's all ego. Yeah. Let's face it, writers' groups, you're dealing with a whole lot of egos. If you're lucky to find someone good, great, but... It's a lot of ego.
Mm. And so finding, having her feedback was really, it was really, really great, because she just kind of let me in on what it was like reading the book, you know.
Yeah.
She would put occasional marginal things to let me know when she was having a nice time.
Oh, aren't they gold? Would, just the smiley face in the margins. You're like, oh, thank God. Thank you. Throw me the bone.
Yeah. So that's really, and, you know, when she was kind of having a hypothesis about what was going to come next, you know, she would say that, so I kind of knew where the reader's mind was kind of heading to.
She sounds
gold. She was great. When she was disappointed, she would say that as well. Where she was confused, she would say it. She was really great, and she told me to put in some extra chapters. Because in the first version, I'd kind of missed out the climax. Kind of thought it would be this great thing.
Oh, that always happens, right?
Yeah. I thought, wouldn't it be great if we built up to a climax and then cut to after it and finding out kind of what happens indirectly. And she said, no, this is horrible. I'm not having it. Yeah.
She just, put the thing in.
Yeah. So that was, I just really enjoyed knowing that and knowing what I needed to write. So it was wonderful. And then since then, I've worked with Scott Pack, who I've since found out Queeve McDonald also works with, who does the kind of structural edit. And I find him to be, the same.
He's great.
He's great. He's really wonderful. He's just the same as my agent was, in that he'll just kind of tell me what the experience of reading it is like as it's going along.
Oh, that's what you want. That's really... Because we... Finding a good editor, did you find him straight off, or did it take you a bit to find him?
I found him on Readsy. And so...
Oh, really?
So on Readsy, the, publishing freelancers website where you can go and hire them all.
It's brilliant.
It's really good. It's a really great... thing. So I did, I created a whatever it's called brief for it and sent it out to seven editors. Yeah, and then obviously went totally insane trying to work out which of them to go with.
Because it's a big decision. You obviously picked well.
Oh yeah, I'm really, really pleased with that. That's one of the few decisions I made where I don't kind of think, oh, stupid, why did I ever do that?
Well, from the outside, I mean, your covers are excellent. I remember first seeing them, and every now and then when I see an excellent cover, I'm like, you sod, where did you get that designer? How did you manage? How did you manage? I talked to myself a bit. But it was a case. Okay. I remember seeing your covers and just going, oh, they're so good.
I redid them when my third book came out. I redid all of them at once.
Yeah, I had the original, and I've got the third one in the new one.
Oh, okay.
The third one with the orange, that's marvellous. Yeah. Three of them look fantastic. I hadn't seen the first two of that series new covers. Okay. And you repackaged them all. Oh, gee, they look good. Who's your artist? So, you've got an excellent artist.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's a friend of mine. So for the When I very first published it, I did the cover myself, which just took an indescribable amount of time and worry and you know, all the rest of it. So when I came to do the second one, I kind of thought, I cannot go through that again.
Yeah.
Because the first one, there was no choice really but to do it myself, because Readsy didn't exist. I didn't know how to. And I didn't want to spend any money either. I did want to do everything myself that first time. The second one, I got a really good cover designer, but then it was felt like he did loads and loads and loads of different versions and none of them were right.
Oh, that's such a tough thing. Oh, yeah. No, I've been there. Where you know they're doing the work and they're doing great work, but you've got that gut feel when it's the right thing, and you're trying to put on your reader hat as well, where you're like, it's just, I know my genre, this isn't hitting it, but I can't tell you why. I've been on the design side of that too, and that's really frustrating as someone who designs stuff, to get the vague, but it is what it is. It's a part of it.
I was also putting them up on, there's a couple of Facebook groups. I was putting them up there, not saying anything about them, but just kind of, you know, saying, what do you think of this? What kind of book do you think it is? And no one liked them, and they all thought they were children's books.
Oh, ouch. Well, then you obviously were doing the right thing in having the qualms about them.
Yeah, no, I think I was right. Yeah. And then a friend of mine did a little sketch, which I thought was great. And eventually I just got the other cover designer to recreate my friend's sketch, kind of in his style. And we used that. But it didn't go with the cover of the first book. Anyway, when the third one came out, a friend of mine decided that
You did all three.
Yeah, a friend of mine decided he wants to, who is a good artist, decided he wanted to become a cover designer. He and another friend of mine really thought about it kind of carefully about, you know, what it had to do, what kind of things it had to be like, the feel of the fonts, you know, all that sort of stuff.
They're so good. They're really good. People, if you're listening to this, go and check out Christopher's books. I really think he's just nailed them. You know, the feel of each book. So I'm going to put that window down now. I was just perving on your covers there. it's that thing when you actually see someone who's just gotten their covers so right. And being an indie author, and even with traditional, I got given possibly the worst covers known to humanity, she says, using complete hyperbole, for my first traditional books. They were done in-house and there was no budget for them. And, you know, it was that thing where I actually had friends recommending my book, but in their Facebook posts going, ignore the cover, it's actually a really good book.
Yeah.
And you're going, oh, ouch.
I've seen both kind of sets of versions of your covers, and the new ones really good.
Yeah, no, you haven't seen the original ones. I have scourged them off the planet. They are... The new ones, I'm actually working with a really great Middle Eastern agency. Because of the humour, we were having trouble with attracting very conservative readers. A lot of very conservative people read romance, but I'm a queer woman, I'm liberal, my books are going to have a whole, you know, fruit basket of people in them, and it's probably going to annoy a certain kind of reader. So we were thinking, well, how do we not attract those people? Mm. And we were sitting in a little bar in Greece, and Tony started sketching a Scottish thistle, and it turned into a Scottish thistle that looked like a willy.
Right.
And then we both just looked at each other and went, well, that's pretty much going to scare away anyone who doesn't have the sense of humour. And it's worked out to be one of the best filters ever. So ever since I did that, you know. Because we were like, can we do this? Can we do this? And we did.
I was just kind of thinking, covers have to tell people what sort of thing it isn't, just as much as they have to tell people what sort of thing it is, I think. In mine, there are kind of thriller elements, but anyone who opens one of the books kind of expecting to find everything that you would enjoy in a John Grisham is really not going to enjoy my books at all.
I wouldn't even put them on the same. John Grisham, I don't think he's ever put a joke in one of his books. I mean, bless him, and his books are great, but I don't think there's any humour. I remember picking up your first one, and I remember laughing within the first paragraph, and I was like, okay, this is This is for me. Yeah, I really love them. Yeah, I've just realized we've chewed through the time. I've really enjoyed this conversation. God. I really, really have. I have a thing that I like to ask people at the end of my podcast. If you could give anyone advice based on your own experience who wants to start to kick off, it doesn't have to be profound. It just has to be whatever advice you think would, either most help you, when you started, or just advice on today. What would it be?
I think it would be something about pleasing yourself. Because I feel like, I went to this self-publishing conference thing ages ago, and there's this really kind of self-satisfied panel. Someone said, what do you need to do to be successful in self-publishing? And they said, just write a good book. And I just, that's such an unhelpful thing.
It's not helpful at all, because what's good? What's good for your audience?
Yeah,
what's good?
Exactly.
We're all neurotic. We're all neurotic. I'm going to be the first one sitting there telling you my book's shit.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's got whatever, it doesn't work. Yeah.
So I think that kind of trying to write, having the goal of writing a good book, that kind of puts you in the same territory as, when you're in an exam and you're trying to second guess what the examiner's going to like.
You're
and
so right.
And so you
kind
of think, obviously I need subtexts and sub-themes, and I need to be saying something profound about, whatever it is. You'll come up with a kind of set of ingredients which might make it kind of a worthy book, but probably won't make it a book that anyone can enjoy. I think books actually don't have to be very good in the end, that all they have to do is they have to make some people love them, and it doesn't matter if they also, I constantly try to remind myself this, it actually doesn't matter if a book makes some people hate it, all that matters is it possible for someone to love this book as a thing in itself. I think that what you write has to be something that you, for yourself, just as a thing in itself, that you love, that you have to please yourself in that way, once you've read it and once you've written it and you put it away for a while, when you read it back, it kind of has the effect on you that you want books by other people to have.
Isn't that a wonderful feeling, though? You read after a while and you might have been really negative. I know, speaking from my own experience, I'll finish a book and I'm like, I'm done. It's being filed away. Don't want to look at it. Banish it to the nether regions of hell. And then I'll pick it up 3 months later and go, actually, this is pretty good. Like, I'm really liking this. That's a good feeling, right?
It's a really lovely feeling, yeah. I mean, I never think this is pretty good, but I do kind of think.
You should. Oh my goodness.
I do think I am actually really genuinely enjoying this, and it's perfectly conceived as a thing for me to really genuinely enjoy reading.
Yeah.
It kindles the right feelings in me as I'm reading it. I think ultimately that's all
you can ask for.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's the whole reason to do it, because it's a love. It's really often a lovely feeling to be writing that, or to be working further towards that, and also just this feeling of kind of, especially towards, because I write in drafts, and I always much prefer the later into the process I go, the more I enjoy it. And
the first draft for me is just me sitting there just swearing at myself most of the time. By the time it gets to about the fourth draft, I'm like, oh, this is fine. I can fix this.
But well, for me, it's more like, anyway, that's probably a separate thing. But there's something about this feeling of, like, suddenly I can see what this is, and I can see when bits of it are this and when bits of it aren't this. My job now is just to get rid of the bits that aren't it. And
it's a good feeling.
Yeah, just this feeling that it is itself, it's a thing in itself, and that's kind of the way it's meant to be. I lose touch with this a bit after it's been out for a long time and I haven't read it for a long time.
But you're going to have to go back and read all of your books, because they are quite wonderful. just in case you're not feeling marvellous about them right now. I'm fresh off of finishing your last one, so I'm in a good book glow.
Well, thank you very much for reading
them. Oh, well, thank you for writing them. Shall we leave the episode there? Are you fine?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I went on for ages again.
Oh, no, look, you are a wonderful guest. Thank you so much. You're an absolute joy. Isn't he awesome? I really enjoyed that chat. It really left me feeling great, actually. He's just such a lovely guy. Okay, just some housekeeping news for you guys. I'm going to be traveling for the next 3 weeks. Actually, I'm going to be traveling indefinitely again. Tony and I are hitting the road, and that means that we've got to get back into a schedule. And usually when we're doing that, going and house sitting full time, it takes, you know, a couple of weeks to find our feet. We're going to be hitting Singapore first and then Penang afterwards. So these podcasts might just be a little bit intermittent while we're getting over jet lag and working out how to make everything work while living out of suitcases, as we are wont to do. But in the interim, if you would like to check my stuff out, go to eviesnow.com or overlondon.net. Massive thanks to Tony Johnson for doing the sound and editing on this podcast. I really look forward to talking to you again the minute we sort our stuff out. I've got some really great guests in the can. It's just going to be a matter of when we can get them edited up and to you, hopefully sooner rather than later. But for now, I hope you're having an amazing week and look forward to talking to you soon.